Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're embarking on a truly fascinating journey into the history of Ceylon tea.
It's a great topic.
Yeah. Our mission is to uncover the pivotal moments and the unique characteristics that really transformed it into this globally recognized symbol of quality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm just captivated by this question of how an entire country's agricultural focus could shift so dramatically. All kind of thanks to one plant.
It is a remarkable transformation, yeah. And it really begins with an unexpected turn of events back in 19th century Ceylon.
Right, because if you were there in British colonial Ceylon, Sri Lanka now, obviously back in the mid-1800s, it was all about coffee, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Coffee was king. You'd see coffee plantations everywhere.
But then disaster struck.
Exactly. And this is the fascinating part, how a devastating coffee rust disease, they call it Himalaya vastatrix, hit in the 1860s.
And just wiped things out.
Completely wiped out those flourishing coffee plantations. It wasn't just, you know, a small problem. It was an economic catastrophe. But paradoxically, it opened the door. It created this vacuum that allowed an entirely new industry to emerge, one that would really redefine the nation.
So the shift wasn't instant, I gather.
No, not immediate. It took time. Mm-hmm. But it spurred experiments, you know, importing tea seeds, looking at what was working in China and India.
Okay, so the door opens, and this is where individuals start to make a difference, right? Tell us about James Taylor. He seems key.
James Taylor, yeah, a Scottish planter. He is absolutely that pivotal figure. In 1867, he planted the very first commercial tea plot, just 19 acres.
Only 19 acres?
Just 19 acres on the Little Kundera estate up in Kandy. Mm-hmm. But his contribution, well, it went way beyond just planting seeds.
How so?
He was known for his, meticulous attention to detail, really innovative techniques for the time. He developed efficient processing methods. He even established the island's very first tea factory right there on the estate.
So he wasn't just growing it. He was figuring out how to make it into the tea people would drink.
Precisely. He basically wrote the early playbook for Ceylon tea production. Really makes you think, doesn't it? How the dedication of just one person can fundamentally reshape an entire economy.
It's incredible. Taylor's story is, yeah, a perfect example of that vision and execution seizing an opportunity.
Definitely. Taking that crisis and turning it into something completely new. A testament to individual agency, really.
And reshape it. It certainly did. Because by the late 19th century, tea wasn't just filling the gap. It became Ceylon's main export, right? Surpassing coffee entirely.
Oh, completely. The growth was rapid.
How did the island even handle that kind of boom?
Well, stepping back, it shows how agricultural innovation needs that infrastructure support, you know?
Right.
So the rapid expansion demanded robust support systems. This meant crucial developments like building railways and roads. These were absolutely vital for getting the tea from the plantations, often in hilly areas, down to the ports for shipping.
Makes sense. You need to move the product.
Exactly. And a really key moment was the establishment of the Colombo Tea Auction in 1883.
Ugh, the auction. Still famous today.
Still huge today. That really solidified Ceylon tea's place in the global market. And all this growth, it spurred significant economic development across the island, created, you know, countless jobs. It's a perfect example, really, of agriculture and trade infrastructure working together to build a powerhouse.
And with that kind of growth and global recognition, I imagine certain places, certain estates started to gain a reputation, building that premium image.
Yes, absolutely. These estates became synonymous with quality. You had places like Pedro Estate up in Nuwara Eliya, known for really delicate, fragrant teas.
Okay.
Then there's the Dambuten Estate, famously founded by Sir Thomas Lipton himself.
This Lipton.
The very same. His estate was known for richer, more full-bodied teas, and maybe Le Bukele Estate, also in the Central Highlands, which quickly got a reputation for teas with really unique flavor profile, reflecting its specific location.
So different estates, different characteristics even early on.
Definitely. The diversity was already starting to show.
Okay, let's jump forward a bit. Sri Lanka gains independence in 1948. How did the tea industry evolve in that post-independence era? Did things change much?
Things did change, yeah. It continued to develop, of course, but there was a really significant turning point in the 1970s.
What happened then?
The government nationalized the plantations.
Ah, right. That was a big move.
Huge move. The stated aim was really about ensuring fair treatment and better working conditions for the laborers, trying to address some of the historical inequalities from the colonial plantation system.
And after nationalization.
Well, following that, there were significant efforts towards modernization. introducing more advanced processing techniques, but also, importantly, a greater focus started to emerge on sustainable farming practices.
Interesting. So it wasn't just about economics anymore.
Exactly. What's fascinating there is that deliberate attempt to blend economic development with, you know, social responsibility as the industry evolved.
That blend of history, economics, and social change is really compelling. And it kind of leads us perfectly into what makes Ceylon tea so special today, that incredible diversity of flavor.
Well, yes.
It really makes you think, how does the land itself, the landscape, shape the taste in your cup so much?
It's fundamental. Sri Lanka's diverse climate, the varied terrain, the different elevations, and it all means that where the tea is grown fundamentally impacts the final character of the tea.
Okay, let's unpack that. How does it work? Can you give us a tour of the key regions?
Absolutely. Think of it like a spectrum of flavors directly linked to the island's geography.
Right.
So starting high up in Nuwara Eliya, we're talking central highlands, maybe around 6,000 feet. It's cool. It's misty.
Okay.
And that produces teas that are generally light, delicate, really fragrant, with a beautiful golden color. They often call it the champagne of Ceylon tea.
Champagne of Ceylon. I like that. What about lower down?
Okay, moving to mid-elevations. On the eastern slopes, you have Uva. That's maybe 3,000 to 5,000 feet. Mm. It gets these unique seasonal dry winds.
And that does what to the tea?
It creates a tea that's aromatic, quite smooth, mellow, but with this distinct, slightly pungent, almost exotic flavor. Very characteristic.
Interesting. And other mid-elevation spots.
Well, over on the western slopes, at similar altitudes, you find Dimbula. It tends to be cooler and wetter than Uva during its quality season.
So different climate, different tea.
Exactly. Dimbula teas are typically richer, more full-bodied, robust, with a distinct golden-orange hue in the cup. Great for iced teas, actually.
They're cute. Okay. Keep going.
Then there's Kandy, the original area, remember? Lower mid-region, say 2,000 to 4,000 feet. More moderate climate.
And the tea.
Generally strong, full-bodied, often quite malty with a bright coppery tone. You find Kandy teas used a lot in breakfast blends because of that strength.
Makes sense. Are there low-grown teas too?
Oh, yes. Down in the south, in Ruhuna, you're at lower elevations, up to maybe 2,000 feet. It's warm, it's humid, closer to the coast.
So bolder flavor.
Definitely. Ruhuna produces teas that are dark in the cup, rich, robust, full-bodied, with strong, quite bold flavors.
Yeah.
Very different from Nuwara Eliya.
It really is a huge range. Are there others?
Yeah. There are a couple more key ones, often mentioned. Uda Pusalawa. It's sort of between Uva and Nuwara Eliya geographically, and often in character too. Medium-bodied, rosy hue, maybe a hint of mild astringency. And Sabaragama in the southwest, also low-grown like Ruhuna, producing full-bodied, dark, strong teas, often used in blends as well.
Wow. It really is a tapestry of flavors, all from one relatively small island. Incredible.
It truly is.
And protecting that quality, that reputation across all these diverse regions must be a huge task. Which brings us to the Sri Lanka Tea Board and that famous lion logo you see on packs.
Yes, the lion logo.
What does that actually signify for, you know, someone buying the tea?
It's incredibly important. It's a globally recognized symbol, really, of authenticity and excellence. Essentially, if you see that logo, it guarantees that the tea inside is 100% pure Ceylon tea, packed in Sri Lanka, and meets the stringent quality standards set by the Sri Lanka Tea Board.
So it's a quality guarantee.
It is. The Tea Board enforces this through regular inspections, yeah. Rigorous testing. It ensures that what you're buying lives up to the Ceylon tea name. Ultimately, you know, that level of quality control is just paramount for maintaining a premium global brand.
Absolutely. And beyond that quality control, it sounds like the industry has also really started to embrace more modern values, particularly around sustainability.
Yes, very much so. In recent years, there's been a significant push towards more sustainable practices. It's focusing on both environmental conservation and social responsibility.
What kind of initiatives are we talking about?
Well, you see things like fair trade certification becoming more common. Organic farming is gaining momentum too.
Right.
And that involves concrete efforts like, you know, reducing the reliance on chemical fertilizers and pesticides,
yeah.
Actively promoting biodiversity on the estates, implementing water conservation measures, things like that.
And the social side?
On the social side, it's about ensuring fair wages, safe working conditions for the laborers, recognizing their absolutely vital role in the whole process.
That seems increasingly important for consumers worldwide.
It is. And it raises that key question, you know, how do these ethical and environmental commitments shape the future appeal, the viability of Ceylon tea? In today's market, these practices aren't just nice to haves. They're becoming essential for consumer trust and, frankly, long-term brand relevance.
That's a critical point for any global industry today, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So as we bring this deep dive to a close, it's clear that Ceylon Tea's journey is remarkable from those, you know, 19th century colonial origins, that coffee crisis,
yeah,
to its status now as this globally celebrated product. It really is a legacy built on tradition, yes, but also so much innovation and this constant pursuit of excellence.
And it's those distinct flavors, those aromas from each unique region that truly create that rich diversity we talked about. It's all continually reinforced by those rigorous quality standards and increasingly that deep commitment to sustainability.
Yep.
It really is a story of adaptability and constant improvement.
So maybe the next time you brew a cup of Ceylon tea, whether it's, you know, a strong, robust black tea to start your day, or maybe a delicate golden cup in the afternoon, just take a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that rich history. Consider the specific hillsides it might have come from, the dedication to quality that shaped it, and that growing commitment to sustainability, protecting its future.
Yeah.
Understanding the story behind something as familiar as tea, it can really deepen your appreciation, can't it? For global agriculture, for trade, and just for those, well, unexpected journeys that end up defining entire nations.